voice in the community. The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
You're listening to the Space Show with Andrew Rennie. Welcome now to the fifth Space Show special from the Kennedy Space Center. We are covering a conference called by United States President Barack Obama and NASA entitled American Space Program for the 21st Century. Obama has gathered the foremost movers and shakers in the space program to garner ideas on how his recently announced space policy can be implemented. The conference began with a speech by Obama. You can find some of my photos of Obama delivering this speech on the Space Show pages on the Southern FM website. Visit www.southernfm.com.au/space. Then follow the link to my Florida diary. Following the president's speech, the conference broke up into four parallel sessions. One of those was called Increasing Access to and Utilization of the International Space Station. Many billions of dollars had been spent building the space station. In 2010 April, the station was nearing completion after a 12-year construction period. Under the Bush administration, planning the station would be operated for another 5 years. Then, in 2015, it would be decommissioned and deorbited. Obama decided to support its operation until at least 2020. With the space shuttle planned to be retired at the end of 2010, another way to access the station by American astronauts was going to be needed. Buying flights on the Russian Soyuz was seen by most Americans as unpopular, but in the short term, necessary. Obama decided to authorize private companies to develop manned and cargo craft to service the space station. That would free NASA to devote itself to planning and executing deep space missions to asteroids and Mars. What still had to be decided was how to best get to the space station and how to use the station. That was the task of a conference session headed by journalist Miles O'Brien. He opened proceedings by referring to his experience at the launch of a Russian Soyuz spacecraft from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan.
And it was at that moment when Mike Fole was explaining what a noctilucent cloud was to me. It's always good to have him nearby. That I reflected a little bit on the station and my experience covering it. I remember very distinctly November of 2000 being at the Baikonur Cosmodrome. I believe you were there.
Yes, it was very foggy. And we were in a bar.
Pea soup thick fog. Yep. And the only way we knew that it had taken off at all, this is Shepard and crew, Krikalev, and the third was, I can't remember, it was Shepard, Krikalev, and...
Gidzenko,
I knew you'd remember that. The only way we knew was by hearing it, and you could see a little bit of the flame through the pea soup fog, and suddenly I realized why the Russians are always so skeptical when we would have a wave off here, because there was a crosswind in Morocco. You know, they launch in most any condition. Hailstorms, they go. So, but what has happened in that period of time is we're approaching a decade of continuous manned operation on the International Space Station. And so when I hear people in certain quarters say, this is the end of the human space program, I scratch my head and say, why don't you just look up in the sky some night, and you're going to see we have an impressive capability, which is only now getting to the point where we can utilize it and achieve some sort of scientific benefit from it. We've spent, it's well into the nine figures on this thing, and it is now all but finished, capable of supporting a crew of six, up to a dozen people for longer periods of time. There is tremendous capability there, and I don't think we really fully appreciate, and this is the nature of exploration and science, of course, what we might learn from this tremendous asset. So imagine, if you will, after all this, I mean, this goes back to Ronald Reagan and Space Station Freedom in 1984 in its first iteration. Imagine if we had gotten to this point and the decision was made to deep six it in 2015 or at the early part of 2016. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. I don't think that's a proper way to spend the taxpayers' money, and we would never know what kind of science we might get out of this amazing vehicle. So I think we're on the cusp of something big there. And I think there are, it's not just something that NASA scientists. It's not something that just government scientists have to be a part of. It is a national lab, and we hope, and this is what I want to hear from our panelists about, we hope that, that NASA, the space agency, is forward-leaning in looking at ways to embrace commercial utilization of this facility. Whether it's for basic science, that might be something that's not, it's a little harder for commercial players, but there are things we will discover in the pharmacological area that, that might very well be of great interest to commercial players. And we only are just scratching the surface on that. I was talking to Julie Robinson, who is head of science for the space station, and she was telling me about just some, you know, they, like they're just getting started. They've had 400 experiments on there and just a handful of papers so far because, frankly, we've been busy building the thing. But we've already come up with ways to improve the delivery of drugs, encapsulating them essentially in tiny microscopic balloons. We are just now trying to figure out what we can do by growing these near-perfect three-dimensional protein crystals, which allow pharmacological companies to come up with novel ways to fight cancer. We're looking at ways to how liquids flow in weightlessness are very useful, for example, for learning how groundwater flows here on the planet. It also gave them a good idea for a zero-G coffee cup, which is important, too. Salmonella, we're going to hear a little bit about that. It turns out that the virulence of salmonella goes from 10 to 11 in space, and so that has helped. That's not exactly a technical term. That was a Spinal Tap reference. But in any case, it actually makes it easier to understand how to come up with a vaccine for things like salmonella. That could be just the beginning of some very exciting vaccine research. They've come up with all kinds of remote medicine applications, which are applicable not just in space, but in remote parts of the world where a doctor is nowhere nearby. That's just scratching the surface. We've just begun. We have a tremendous panel here. I'm going to introduce them briefly, and they've got their own pitch, but we're going to hear from the space station briefly before that. But first, we have Michael Fola. No, it's Fola. He has a PhD in astrophysics from Cambridge University. He's an astronaut in 1987, six spaceflight missions, went to Mir when they were still, you know, putting the smoke out of it, right, essentially, after the fire and some difficulty, helped get Mir actually back in shape, then had a long stint as commander of the International Space Station, and he's available to be hired as a commercial astronaut, I'm told. I overheard that on the bus, at least, Brewster. And, have astronaut training, we'll travel. Our next panelist is Tom Pickens. He's a successful space entrepreneur. I'll say that again, a successful space entrepreneur. How often do you hear those words together, all right? This is we're on the cusp of something new. He is at the pointy edge of the spear here. Worked with a company initially called SpaceHab, and it's now called Astrogenics.
Astrogenetics.
And Astrotech as well, and I'll let you explain all the things you're up to.
Astrotech's the parent, Astrogenetics is the sub.
Anxious to use the station and come up with ways to utilize zero-G environment to learn new things. Brett Alexander, who is the president of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation and is a lot of experience inside the White House and in the Office of Science and Technology Policy under Presidents Clinton and Bush, and is now leading the charge on coming up with ways to develop a vibrant private sector space industry. That's an exciting prospect for a lot of us who'd like to see, you know, in 50 years of space travel, we've had all 500 people go. I'd like to see 500 people go a week. And how's that going to happen? Well, one of the ways it's going to happen is that we have to open up the private sector. You know, I think there are probably two big motivators in life, fear and greed. Yeah, we got to the moon basically on fear. I think this next space race, if you will, maybe a little greed would be good to motivate people. A profit motive might get us a little bit farther than we can imagine. All right, let's begin with that. Let's go from that to Mike Fola, who's looking longingly, kind of wishing he was up there, I think. Mike, why don't you talk a little bit about some of the specifics of how you could envision the space station being utilized in the future?
Miles O'Brien, opening the space station session at President Obama's Space Conference. The first of the three panelists to speak was, as you've just heard, going to be a British-born astronaut, Mike Fola. Now, several days before this conference, I had interviewed Mike about his spaceflight experiences aboard the Russian space station Mir, the space shuttle, and the International Space Station. And then just as we concluded the interview, we rushed outside and we watched the space station go over, and then we watched the launch of the space shuttle STS-131. Now, that interview with Mike Fole can be heard on a forthcoming space show. Right now, we go back to the conference at the Kennedy Space Center.
I just want to make sure that people know a little bit of the context. I'm an active astronaut today. I represent the astronaut office and have to be careful what I commit my colleagues to or not doing when I talk here behind this panel. My mother's, just for those of you who don't know me, my British accent's, it's all right, I'm an authenticated American. I'm not House, so I'm not Hugh Laurie. My mum's American. Mom. My first flight, I've flown 5 times on the space shuttle, 1 time on a Soyuz rocket. On the times that I've flown on the shuttle, the first 2 flights were scientific missions independent of a space station, observing the Earth from space. It was the Atlas 1 and Atlas 2 series of missions on STS-45 and 56. Happened to be with Charlie Bolden, my commander, my first commander. He was a wonderful commander. He told me to get a will. Now, I want to make that point seriously. He told me to get a will, and none of us had wills of the new guys. So we are dealing with a risky business, and I thank him for the advice. That said, I flew 5 times on the space shuttle and then 1 more time on a Soyuz rocket. Those science missions were important, but of course we were even then looking towards the space station. In 1997, I had a great adventure, which was to be launched to the Mir space station. And I was launched on a space shuttle that took me in a model which we're going to use, I think, a lot today, which was the taxi model. That is, there were 7 crew members, and I was the 7th, and I was delivered to a space station. And then the space shuttle left, STS-84 left, and left me on the space station, Mir, not without a ride home, I should add, but at least my planned time home was dependent on the next ride coming up. On the Mir, I did some science, but it was interrupted by a series of unfortunate events on the Mir stations, and it was probably the lowest point in the Russian space program that I have had any experience with. Since then, when a cargo ship collided with the Mir station. Since then, the Russians have been extraordinarily reliable partners, and we, as a result of that collision, I think, paid a lot more attention to what Russia was doing in its program. And so today, they do represent the United States' method for getting astronauts to the International Space Station in a model which I would call the rental car model, whereby the astronauts and cosmonauts that are going to space station are on the vehicle that they would come home in. They're not waiting to be picked up. When I went to the International Space Station as the commander in 2003-2004, I went with only 6 months of training on that Soyuz vehicle because up to that point I'd intended to go on the space shuttle, and we had Columbia. Columbia occurred, and we were rapidly redirected, all of us, to recover from that accident. And my part in it was to sustain space station operations post-Columbia on the International Space Station with one other crew member, one other person, Alexander Kaleri. I have a general theme here, which is the more people on the space station, the more I think we will get out of it. I think interaction in general with a fairly large number of people on the station is quite realistic. If there are psychologists here saying there's a problem, in general, I've always had the most positive experiences with the larger crews, and with 2 people, it was rather hard going for 6 months. On the space station, at that time, in 2004, we had 1 visiting vehicle. That was a progress. It came around about Christmas. This year, about 20 vehicles are going to visit the International Space Station. So when he says 500 people in a week, we have a serious parking problem. I mean, the traffic model does need to increase, and it's critical that traffic model of once every 6 months that the astronaut office thinks of is thrown away. We need to have a much more frequent traffic model going to the International Space Station. I think there are lots of ways, there's lots of reasons why that could come to pass. The other thing about my most recent experience was that with the Columbia down, with the shuttle system down, the United States had this incredible investment in space, extraordinary amount of money, and yet we didn't have access to it without reverting to or resorting to a parallel path to low Earth orbit, which was the Russians. And that parallel path is key to, I think, the direction that we're hearing today in the president's proposal to enable commercial spaceflight to low Earth orbit. We need a redundant and parallel path as a nation to get to our investment in space. That would be true even if we were trying to go to the moon, and even if we were trying to go beyond the moon to Mars, or to, for example, an L1 propellant depot. Either way, you need, if you're going to put a lot of money into an object in space that you need to get to, you need to have two ways to get there, at least. That said, with a strong Russian partner and a U.S. national launch system, we meet the requirements, I believe, of parallel path to get to our investment. But when the space shuttle is retired, we are now we're in a difficult position, and the Russians are in a difficult position. They are the only path to the International Space Station, and they won't be as happy with that situation, really, as we are. Any happier, I mean. So the point I'm making here is it's very important that the commercial crew efforts to get astronauts to space station happen soon. And I have had the privilege to take part in assessing the NASA commercial needs for getting crew to space station and to low Earth orbit. And my mantra in all of those assessments was soon. The sooner you can achieve this, the better. This commercial effort also will fail, in my mind, if it only produces one successful provider of launch services. There needs to be more than one provider of launch services for the United States to low Earth orbit, if it's really a success, because then it does make the United States independent of another nation's capability. Or you invite more nations into the International Space Station and your projects to make those parallel paths. So there's two ways to do it for the United States. One is to create more than one provider in the U.S. or have more partners, international partners. Science on the station. I really enjoy science. I'm a physicist, astrophysicist. I did a set of experiments on the space station that I found very interesting. About 72 experiments were taking place while I was there. Only about three or four of them really involved me directly. Two of us were on the station, and I was spending about a quarter of my time, at the most, doing science on the space station. Today, with a six-person crew, a much larger fraction, I think, is spent of the total crew time on science, and should be spent on science. But then we were sustaining station operations, and we needed experiments, but we didn't have any way to launch them. And I think in the end, the 8 kilometers a second that you need to get into low Earth orbit is the key, and is the barrier, and is the problem to all of the things that we're addressing today. And this shift to commercial crew is all about getting that 8 kilometers a second for your payloads, for your experiments, for the ticket buyers, for the propellant depot in L1. It's all about overcoming that 8 kilometer per second energy problem, which is how much energy you need to get a person into space, or a kilogram into space. I think it's fantastic that the ISS is going to go to 2020. The ISS is going to be used for, I'm going to just roll them off. Robotics is one thing which the ISS is developing that is often missed out when we line up the technologies that are being discussed and the experiments being done. Robotics, actually, the assembly of the U.S. segment of the International Space Station is extraordinary when you think about it. Using the Canadian robotic arm, there's also the Canadian Dexter, the fine manipulator, and there's also a Japanese arm. But robotics in general It turns out to be a really enabling thing on the International Space Station in its construction. But I think if it goes further towards propellant transfer and to the enabling of propellant depots beyond low Earth orbit, if that turns out to be a good way to go beyond low Earth orbit, there may be some cool propellant solutions out there that don't need that. But the way I see it is we will need propellant depot. I'm going to talk about what I'd like to see in space now. I think the greatest thing that's been done by the International Space Station is the partnership with the, with internationals. And I think all kinds of, there are all kinds, yes, there's bureaucracy, yes, there's difficulty in language and interaction, but it's an international partnership ends up being the most sustainable program for a nation. Would it be easy to cancel Constellation if it was international? I don't believe so. The space station has been right on one vote for cancellation, but international helped sustain it. And in the end, international helped us get over the period when we lost our national launch capability. So I think international partnerships should be continued and developed for the International Space Station in its increasing access. Parallel redundant access, I've mentioned. I think more people should be sent to the station. Let me give you an idea. From an astronaut's point of view, my astronaut colleagues say, well, how will I fly to the station if, you know, we're going once every 6 months, there's only three persons, possibly, you know, four persons per year out of the astronaut office, there's no career. Not true if you go right back to what we thought we should do with the station, which is launch every 3 months. Or indeed, we launch a taxi model, which could be carrying not just three people or four people to the station, but seven people to the station. And the other three or four seats are occupied by people who are coming to set up their experiments, tear them down. They come to visit for as long as that vehicle wants to stay at the station. If it happens to be the lifeboat, it will stay. If there's a lifeboat already at the station for assured return, then the taxi can return and be used again for another flight and increase the traffic model of the provider so that their business case is better. So I think the key to the station is getting more, and the type, it could be, and I'll talk about National Lab. I think National Institutes of Health, I think DARPA could have its own section. There are reasons why you can't do military and defense-oriented projects on the International Space Station because it's an international space station. But there's no reason why, and we do commercial proprietary experiments and activities on the space station. And we've already taken part of that, and some of those products are already in the market in terms of protein crystal growth and other samples. So I think data protection, I think commercial and proprietary operations on the station are all things that are in the future and can be done with a larger seat and load factor to the station than we have currently on the Soyuz. And I should point out that the Soyuz is the only vehicle that carries people to the station to live there. The shuttle visits, but it doesn't leave anybody there anymore. We had the last one was, I think, Nicole Stott last year. And finally, I'd like to say I don't think space station should ever be deorbited. And that's not just a whim. If Franklin Chang Diaz is an astronaut who I know well, who is a visionary. He was a fusion physicist originally, but has taken his skills. He's from MIT. To develop a plasma rocket, and there are other ways to get what's called high ISP thrust out of an engine, but he has a system, and it's a fairly well-developed engine that produces very low thrust, but for a very, very, very long duration at a very, very, very high efficiency, and it needs electrical power. And I believe there's a technology program to put, as one of the new technology programs, to put that on the International Space Station. That sort of system can get you to Mars in about 4 to 6 weeks. I did the original calculations for Franklin back in the late 80s and early 90s. That system can get you to Mars in 4 to 6 weeks, spiraling out, accelerating continuously, and then halfway, still spiraling, decelerating, it gets you into Mars. That's how you stop the damage of radiation, for example, between and out of the Earth's magnetosphere. Between Earth and Mars. So if you get short travel times to Mars, short travel times to asteroids, now you can hide behind your celestial body from the sun, from a solar storm. Now you can hide from the galactic cosmic rays if you have materials at hand. And so the key there is the space station needs to be used for propulsion and out of low Earth orbit exploration development. So that same engine could be used to boost the station. And it's part of the demonstration of showing that the Vasimir, as he calls it, works on the International Space Station in the next 2 or 3 years. It should be and could be and be planned to lift the station eventually out of the low Earth orbit that it's in now, when we have decided that our vehicles no longer need to, well, for whatever reason, we can get it higher so that it won't have to be disposed of. It could one day be that the tourist side trip or the special government side trip on the way to an L1 propellant tank farm between the Earth and the Moon. I can obviously go on a long time, but I've left the key we could talk about later on is how would propellant depots meet the needs or sort of provide the market for commercial launch providers.
Astronaut Mike Fole speaking at President Obama's 21st Century Space Conference. At the end of his talk, he mentioned Franklin Chang Diaz's plasma propulsion plans. Some years ago, Franklin, a former astronaut, visited Melbourne. The space show recorded his thoughts on plasma propulsion. You can hear his talk by visiting the space show pages on the Southern FM website at www.southernfm.com.au/space. Now that's all lowercase, and Southern FM is one word, southernfm.com.au/space. And then once there, go to the 2008 lecture page and scroll down to April the 2nd, and you'll see Franklin Chang Diaz there, and you can click on that and you can listen to that previous broadcast. Now, on our next space show, we will hear more ideas on how to use the International Space Station for such things as biotechnology, vaccine development, and long-term job creation. On last week's space show, we brought you part of the announcement of NASA's big new rocket family. Now, before going to Capitol Hill to make the public announcement, NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden broke the news to NASA employees in a special internal message. The space show has that message, which was meant to be heard only within NASA.
Today is a big day at NASA. Later, I'll be joining members of Congress to make a major announcement on our next heavy lift launch system, but I wanted you, members of the NASA family, to hear it first from me. The next chapter of America's space exploration story is being written right here, right now. We've selected the design of a new space exploration system that will take humans far beyond Earth. This important decision will create high-quality jobs here at home and provide the cornerstone for America's future human space exploration efforts. This new heavy-lift rocket will be America's most powerful since the Saturn V rocket that carried Apollo astronauts to the moon. It will launch humans to places no one has gone before, such as asteroids, Mars, and other deep space destinations. In combination with the crew capsule already under development, commercialization of astronaut travel to low Earth orbit, extension of activities on the International Space Station, and a fresh focus on new technologies, this rocket is key to implementing the plan laid out by President Obama and Congress. President Obama challenged us to be bold and dream big, and that's exactly what we're doing at NASA. While I was proud to fly on the space shuttle, tomorrow's explorers will now dream of one day walking on Mars. This launch vehicle decision is the culmination of a months-long, comprehensive review of potential designs to ensure that the nation gets the best possible rocket for the investment, one that's not only powerful, but is also evolvable, so it can be adapted to different missions as opportunities arise and new technologies are developed. The rocket will use liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen fuel systems. RS-25DE engines will provide the core propulsion for the J2X engine is planned for use in the upper stage. There will be a full and open competition to develop the boosters based on performance requirements. Its early flights will be capable of lifting 70 to 100 metric tons before evolving to a lift capacity of 130 metric tons. The early developmental flights will take advantage of existing solid boosters and other existing hardware. This will help us control costs and make early tests smoother. The selection of the vehicle needed to transport our astronauts beyond low Earth orbit is one of the most important decisions NASA will make this decade. It will require a major commitment on the part of the American people. That's why we took the time to get it right. The hard work and expertise of you and the NASA family have brought us to this point. and will be critical as we continue to do the big things that only NASA can do. We must continue to challenge ourselves as a people to reach our highest potential. The future is bright for exploration, and we can be proud of the major step forward we're taking today.
That was NASA Administrator Charlie Bolden in a special message for NASA employees before he headed off up to Capitol Hill to make the announcement public. Up there last week, we heard Senator Bill Nelson, Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Charlie Bolden himself, and Eddie Bernice Johnson, and John Boozman. Now, we didn't quite finish the ceremony last week, so we're going to take a listen now to some of the more of the things that were happening there. And we're going to hear, first of all, from Senator Bill Nelson, who, by the way, flew on board the space shuttle in 1986 as a congressional observer. He was a congressman then, he's now a senator. And we'll also hear from Chaka Futa, who is a congressman from Pennsylvania.
It's important to underscore the administrator's comment about the workforce. This is the most skilled workforce that is a national asset to this country. And with the phase out of the space shuttle, with the building of the commercial rockets scaling up as the space taxi, and then now with the big rocket, the monster rocket, being set, and the contracts, as Kay said, within a week, the contracts being modified, you will see that workforce then start to scale up so that there's not just the precipitous drop that you phase from one right into the other. That was most important to all of us. It's important to the president. And the administrator made that comment in his opening line, and I just wanted to underscore it. We're pleased to have Congressman Chaka Futa from Pennsylvania. He is the ranking member on the CJS Appropriations Subcommittee in the House. Congressman.
Thank you, Senator. Yes, sir. Well, the general said he was proud to have flown on a few of the shuttle missions. He actually commanded two of them, and he is commanding NASA in a way that I think today you see a decision package come together. And as an appropriator, I know that we're pleased to see that the authorizers and the administration have come to an agreement that clearly identifies the president's goal of having us move from exploration in terms of lower orbit to deep space, to Mars as the target. This embrace of the commercial crew program is very important. I am making now this decision around the launch system. Really positions NASA to move forward aggressively. And I want to thank the administrator for his leadership. I know that some of the tussles up here on the Hill can be challenging. But this is rocket science we are dealing with, so it is somewhat complicated for those of us in the realm. But we do want to make sure that our country leads the world. We have led in an absolute way. We know that we have others who have joined this effort in terms of space exploration, but we intend for America to be number one. And we know, as appropriators, that we can't do that on the cheap. It will cost money. We're going to have to invest money as a nation to continue to lead the world. And as an appropriator, it's always helpful to have guidance from the authorizers and to have an agreement so at least we're not working at cross purposes. So I want to thank Senator Hutchinson and my good friend, Senator Nelson, who himself served in a different capacity in our efforts in space at a previous time, for their leadership, along with my colleague, from Texas, Congresswoman Johnson, who has done such great work in the science education area and on behalf of NASA. So thank you.
And that was the events last week on Capitol Hill, where they announced NASA's big new rocket. Well, this program was written and produced and presented by Andrew Rennie.
Community News makes conversation the Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.